Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, October 13th. Monday, January 13th. I don't know where October came from. January 13th, 2025. Joining me in the studio today...
It's Peter R.H. and Stephen.
Stephen Fan.
Stephen's just back from Las Vegas, and he's going to be telling us about his adventures at the Consumer Electronics Show.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Peter, what do you got up for today?
Well, we had a... She didn't say anything, but she used to attend a few of the UBC Anarchist Club meetings right. 40 years ago. Not so much as an anarchist, but as a progressive person.
Right.
I got a hold of her. I remembered her name.
And this is... she's going to be... Her name first.
April Page.
And she's going to be a new part-time participant in
the
program?
Hopefully. I think we talked on Sunday afternoon, and we thought maybe to take a bit more to... I have a written statement from her, which is usually it's not good to read things, but I'm going to do it in the interest of not editing, because you sort of change things in your editorial opinion of what... And and I'm also going to maybe, because she was involved with something I wasn't in the 1980s. That was to establish, to have a crab park.
Right.
And which I, it's sort of interesting that we're not going to have the piece you did. We're going to have it, you're going to have it on later shows about the people that want to do the homeless encampment there.
Yeah.
I kind of saw... a little bit of phoniness in the 80s over kind of the whole Crab Park thing. I mean, she doesn't see it that way herself, but
right.
I kind of, because Jim Green was part of that campaign. And then about 20 years ago, he was against encampments there.
Right.
And I think they're, you know, and... anyway, so we'll be talking a bit about that and other things.
So that's coming later in the show. We're going to start off in a couple of minutes with a report from about the Comox Nation and an important milestone in their journey to self-government. And we also have a report, or an interview rather, from CJSF Danny Nesvaradani about Sterling Winters, who's a performance and voice coach here at SFU, and I think you'll learn some things a bit about being a better presenter. All that and more coming up here, right here on Speak Up Today. We're going to start off with this report from the Comox, from Comox on Vancouver Island about the Comox Nation's important step in appointing a justice of the peace. The first in Canada as part of their journey towards self-government.
On December 4th, 2024, Comox First Nation appointed Dr. Marion Buller as their Justice of the Peace, a first in First Nations history in Canada. This historic moment is the next step in a long journey for the Comox First Nation towards self-determination, building on previous steps like signing to the Framework Agreement in 2014 and voting to approve their land code in 2016. Chief Robert Louis of West Bank First Nation is chairman of the First Nations Land Advisory Board. The Land Advisory Board is an organization that works across Canada to support First Nations communities in their efforts to re-establish control over their lands, natural resources, and environment. One way is through land codes, a level of self-governance achieved by the Comox First Nation in 2016. Chief Louis spoke to CHLY about what it means to be a land code First Nation, how that led to this landmark moment, and what this means for the future of Comox First Nation, as well as other communities across the country.
Yes, a land code First Nation is a government decision maker. It has the community who passes a land code enters the realm of self-government. The parts of the Indian Act disappear and is replaced by the jurisdiction of the First Nation. So at least one-third of the Indian Act is no longer applicable to a First Nation with a land code.
Louis explains that this means the community, in this case Comox First Nation, governs what happens on their lands with full lawmaking capacity. Whether that be leasehold interest, dealing allotments to band members, how deep to put water and sewage lines, or how close to build to water sources.
Anything that affects lands, the community has that full decision-making capacity.
Comox First Nation is one of over 120 communities across Canada to pass land code, with the help of the Lands Advisory Board, Louis says.
This is what is happening across the country, and I know our team. We have a lands board of directors that are reflective of communities right across Canada. We've got resource center staff who, you know, work from Vancouver Island right through to Newfoundland, and so it's a really a good working feeling that yes, we must work together. Don't leave anybody behind.
While Comox First Nation are one of many to pass land code, they are the first to appoint a justice of the peace. Louis shares what it is that qualified Dr. Marion Buller to be the first.
And Dr. Buller is a First Nation member of the Mistawasis Cree First Nation in Saskatchewan and has achieved much in her career over 22 years as a provincial judge.
The Honorable Judge Marion Buller has nearly 40 years of legal expertise and was the first Indigenous woman to be appointed provincial court judge in BC in 1994. Judge Buller was instrumental in establishing the First Nations Court of British Columbia in 2006 and became Chief Commissioner of the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls in 2016. She was appointed Chancellor of the University of Victoria in 2022.
So, you know, high accolades with her background and experience, obviously, there's no doubt that they've made a perfect choice for their justice of the peace.
To explain why this appointment was necessary, Chief Louis points out how Canadian laws all must have enforcement provisions, whether provincial, territorial, or federal.
So when you pass laws, they must be enforced.
Louis goes on to explain how a gap in the justice system has left an issue of recognition and implementation of First Nation laws by policing authorities, creating a gap in enforcement over the past few decades.
In the early days, and I'm going back to the early 1990s, late 1980s, early 1990s, and leading up to our agreement with Canada in our framework agreement, which Canada recognized the inherent rights of First Nations to be self-governing.
Louis describes how at the time they didn't realize there were gaps in Canada's enforcement system, such as the RCMP Police Act not providing clauses or clarity regarding the requirement of the RCMP to enforce First Nation laws.
So consequently, a gap has clearly developed, and policies sometimes intervene, and many communities have no issues with policing and RCMP. Other communities do. And so over time, we've realized that these are real significant issues.
The movement to self-governance evolved from the framework agreement to the passing of land codes at the turn of the millennium. Since then, the number has grown to over 120 communities across Canada with this self-government land management function, including Comox First Nation. But the gap in enforcement persists, as Chief Louis explains.
So the difference here is that while you have the general public having more clarity on how enforcement takes place, how prosecution takes place with First Nations, it's a growing understanding with various levels of government to enforce those laws. So consequently, Comox has had to challenge the laws and ensure their laws are enforced.
Louis shares how that very thing happened with a landmark case in 2018.
And so they were very successful here in 2018 with a landmark court case on trespass, a landlord-tenant situation where their laws, once passed, had to be enforced by the courts and by the RCMP.
Louis says this gap in the system is what led the Comox First Nation to their decision to appoint a Justice of the Peace, the first ever in Canadian First Nations history.
They have expertise now. So now, for them, It means that they have a justice of the peace who can now deal with offenses and implement things like restorative justice.
Louis defines restorative justice as including the victim, the offender, and, depending on the case, even community members, to work out alternative solutions to incarceration.
Here you have the potential of adding more of a traditional flavor to it, having elders circles in place, having sentencing that may be more unique to a community to reflect its own cultures and how they do things.
Louis speaks to why this system is so vital in First Nation communities.
Throughout Canada and BC, not excluded from that, there is a disproportionate number of incarceration of Indigenous peoples. And so it's helping to deal with things like that and helping now that there will be clarity on the enforcement and blending in of the First Nation cultures in the justice system.
Louis says that as Justice of the Peace, Buller will have her hands full, setting the precedent for how things will be done and managing disputes and challenges to laws with fairness and efficiency, providing everyone their right to proper access to the justice system.
And so now she now provides a framework for that justice system to occur and to better reflect enforcement of Comox laws and values and how they wish to move ahead in the in managing their lands and resources.
Louis speaks as well to what it means for Comox First Nation and other communities across the country to have this historic first.
And I suppose when you look at being the first in Canada, they've put history in motion. There always has to be that front end leader that takes the challenge and moves ahead.
Louis says that for Comox First Nation, this means they now have clarity that their laws must be upheld by the Canadian courts, providing comfort when they pass laws. He also says this is setting off a ripple effect to other communities across the country, considering what they can do to expand their own self-governance.
Many communities, not just in British Columbia, but other communities are now seriously looking at how they can further their justice systems and to get clarity on enforcement. So it's set a whole new different meaning to enforcement of First Nation laws.
For CHLY News, this is Heather Watson.
This report, in partnership with CVOX, was made possible with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs program, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
This is Bird Note. In some bird species, males and females look pretty different. For example, male northern cardinals are bright red, and females are mostly brown. In some species, the differences between sexes even help them eat different foods. In the group of hummingbird species called hermit hummingbirds, found in Central and South America, females typically have curved bills, while males have straighter ones. This makes the females better at drinking nectar from flowers with curved bases, while males visit flowers with straight bases. This could help males and females avoid directly competing for the same flowers. The Hispaniolan woodpecker from Haiti and the Dominican Republic also divvies up food resources based on bill size. In this species, males have the bigger bills. They spend more time pecking at bark and probing deep tree holes. Females usually pick at insects and spiders on the surface of leaves and bark. Both the females and males are capable of the same types of feeding. It's a difference in emphasis and how they spend their time. Adaptations like these help birds share space with each other. Avoiding competition has benefits for the whole species. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
This time, Bird Note has excluded the United States also, but it's not even excluded to Canada.
Perhaps, maybe that's fair. We're back with Stephen Fan. He's just back from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, which is, well, tell us very briefly, what is the Consumer Electronics, often known as the CES?
So Consumer Electronics Show actually began in 1967. And originally, it was just that. It was Consumer Electronics. So traditionally, the biggest item in Consumer Electronics shows is television. Mm-hmm. So when it began in the 1960s, it would have been these huge cathode ray tubes. Yeah. And then so I think part of the reason the CES, that is now known, became cool is because there's been such a huge transformation in that core technology from these gigantic cathode ray tubes that cost $4,000 to.
And of course, we also had the emergence of computers and their spin-off technologies, which hugely diversified the sort of products that were being presented there.
Yeah, and I think that what really spun it into high gear was the emergence, as you said, of information technology, you know, all these tech giants. And this is a really surprising thing because people go to Consumer Electronics Show to really, quote-unquote, gawk at cool gizmos. Mm-hmm. But and that there's huge of that. There's 64 football fields worth of hardware exhibits and exhibits in general, just gizmos, nonstop, too much, really. But with there's also really a separate side of the CES, which is slightly smaller, but not much smaller, and that's all the tech giants. And what they're doing there is essentially negotiating all the advertising, the content deals, and stuff like that with the creators who tend to just kind of take it as a one-week kind of paid-for party. And they have, you know, if you go to the Aria Hotel right in the middle of Vegas, which is kind of the media side of things, there are literally thousands of corporate hospitality suites just booked up completely solid in the middle of the day. And there are all these like heralds and, you know, messengers running around for Google and directing people to their meetings. It's complete, you know, babble. It's insane. And it's just like it's the busiest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. So it's crazy, but it also shows kind of the side of the tech business, media business, that's often kind of not as noticed beside the cool gizmos. But there are a lot of cool gizmos.
And you have a bunch of them you want to talk about, or at least trends.
Well, I can try. Gizmo. I mean, there's a ton. So I'm going to actually start with something that was in the previous segment, which is birds. And one thing that was actually huge this year is kind of this kind of bird tech, bird feeders, really. And you might ask, why are bird feeders a hit? They just provide food for the birds. And actually, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Because when you have a bird feeder in your yard, you know, you might not always catch a glimpse of the bird. But with a little bit of a tech, like, you know, kind of disguised cameras, kind of intelligent kind of trail cam kind of setup, you can basically capture really good photos of the birds with like cameras like littered throughout your yards. And sometimes these things are disguised as flowers in bright colors. It's pretty cool. And the appeal of this technology is really kind of it's cheap, it's easy, and it's a kind of a big gain without too much of a cost. But I guess kind of in that line, I think what's interesting this year at CES is that, you know, for the past 2 years, everyone's been talking nonstop about AI, LLM, and deep learning, and all that stuff. And actually, I think everyone's a little bit tired of it at CES. Like, if you go to the talks by tech insiders, like, you know, the talk by the Facebook CMO, mostly people are not really talking about, you know, AI writing emails for you. I think one thing that's actually struck me as a better, much more interesting use of the AI, and that's much more promising in the future, if you just walk around the exhibits, there's so many robot exhibits that are now plausible because of AI. Because the robots is kind of like a very Jetsons kind of an idea. You know, you have the robot servants and stuff like that. I don't think we're quite there yet, and we might never be. But one thing that has become a lot more plausible in the robot world is that you can have, you know, very affordable actuators, which is kind of the things that connect all the segments of the robots. That's the hardware side. And you can also do really cheap and fast training of the robots to, let's say, walk naturally or wash your dishes or potentially cook some food with kind of AI neural nets. And that's just something that's become a lot more affordable and accessible now compared to a couple of years ago. So, like, you know, the robot exhibits are like, you know, you walk around the floor, it's like 50% from China, 30% from Korea, 20% from everyone.
And are these primarily humanoid-type robots?
So that's the interesting question. No. The answer is humanoid robots are probably, in many ways, not where the future is primarily going, because humanoid robots have a very physical limitation, which is that they have to walk on 2 feet.
Yeah.
And it turns out bipedalism is shockingly difficult for robots. Like, it's so insanely difficult that the entry-level humanoid robot by Unitree, which is like one of the top two robot makers in the world, cost $18,000 or $27,000 US in the United States.
Yep.
And an entry-level four-legged with wheels, like a four-legged dog robot, costs $1,600. So an order of magnitude difference.
Right.
So just bipedalism is an incredibly challenging thing. There are actually a lot of really rapid advances to make the walking gait seem more natural and, you know, not tip over all the time. But these things will always remain.
So you mean instead of legs, you would have wheels, basically?
So actually, this is the other thing. So I think this is the other trend in robotics, that robot dogs, because they have four legs, were kind of always a convenient typology for robots. But people started with legs. You know, legs are kind of a cool, looks natural. But I think where things are going is with wheels. Why I say that is that Unitree, again, one of the top two robot makers in the world, they released a video in December of their new robot dog with wheels. This is like their top-end industrial model. Costs $100,000. You can't really buy as a consumer. But the wheels go up really fast. And it's so designed that you can throw it from a wall 2 meters high, and it's totally fine. It flips itself over, keeps going. It climb up and down stairs. And this is the most important thing: it could carry a human.
All right.
So you can't really ever design a robot dog with traditional feet that can carry a human. It's just way too difficult. But like robot dogs with four wheels, you're basically combining a robot with a mobility scooter.
Mm-hmm.
And at some price point, that would be valuable for the consumer.
Well, you know, a mobility scooter or a mobility wheelchair are already hugely expensive.
Yeah.
And right? So we're not talking about getting down to hundreds of dollars necessarily in that context.
Yeah, that's the other thing, right? And one of the most interesting pieces of technology I saw this year was actually a company called Strut, which makes intelligent wheelchairs.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea of it is that they would navigate around bumps and hazards and so forth, obstacles. And I tried it on the floor, actually. The first thing I noticed about their wheelchair is that it's incredibly sleek. It's like in this all black, you know, like metal and stuff. And it's really fast. The power is huge. I don't know how good their obstacle avoidance thing is, because it's a flat floor with no obstacles. But it looks pretty cool. People were raving about it. I don't know to what extent the tech will get applied, but I think some version of it will sort of start to flow out, because there's a lot of tech actually that will have implications for accessibility. There is a set of smart glasses which will actually beam information directly into your eyes from a light. And there is a set of VR glasses which can help people with very severely reduced sight.
Yeah.
I was speaking with a guy, a very chipper Aussie guy at an audio booth. So it's an Australian company, but collaborating with a Chinese company making audio equipment. And what's sort of interesting is that, you know, like there are hearing aids, right?
Yeah.
But like your hearing aid, you know, traditionally, it tries to magnify the stuff it hears in an environment. But a lot of the times, let's say in an airport or evacuation setting, it's just a lot easier if you can have a central source of information that beams to your hearing aid. And it's not because it can't connect to Wi-Fi or Bluetooth and like that. Is that it kind of requires a special form of hearing, sort of like connection technology, which was not widely adopted.
Right.
But it looks like there's going to be a different kind of hearing aid coming along, and that would have previously cost $20,000, and now it's $200.
Right.
And you can wear that hearing aid, and it could either magnify what's immediately in your environment, or there can be a central source beaming to it if you choose.
Communicating
and just telling you, like at the airport, telling you what's the departures, or you need to evacuate, or stuff like that. So I think all these accessibility tech, I think, is actually super, super fascinating.
Well, I even saw a report recently that Apple has done an update for their AirPods, which allows them to be used as hearing aids.
Yes, that's true. And I do think that, that's going to be a huge game changer because it's going to make hearing aids much more affordable. Mm-hmm. I think this is the kind of the next step where you're making hearing aids not just having to pick up sort of sound in the environment, which is not might not be easy to translate in that direction, but also just having like much better signal that just comes straight from a source that you can just use.
I could see that highly applicable, not even outside of the hearing aid space, because people often wear their AirPods a lot. You're at the airport.
Yeah.
It's like you're listening to your music. Maybe you're missing out on things you need to know, whereas if it beam, you know, you could, I imagine eventually once you book your flight, it's going to beam you specifically information about your flight and not everything.
Yeah, so the technology, it's really a protocol. It's really a signaling protocol between these devices, and it already exists in hospitals and stuff like that. But what I think the new change is really just making it down to like the $200 level instead of like the $20,000 medical grade level, right? So I think that could be a big deal for people who are accessibility challenged.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so we don't have unlimited time, so let's jump on to some other things that you saw there.
Yeah, so the other things I saw are, you know, like, you know, AI, obviously everyone talks about AI. There's, you know, display tech. So everyone always talks about newer and bigger TVs. Mm-hmm. I think normal people don't find it super interesting, but there is one new TV tech that's coming online, and that's kind of, it's the first consumer micro LED TV. So it's worth explaining very quickly what that is. Micro LED TV is not like a traditional TV where you have pixels and then you have a backlight beaming into your eyes. And micro LED TV is that every single light source is just a pixel.
So each pixel is its own light source.
You can turn on and off individual pixels. So in theory, this creates infinite contrast. If you do it with LEDs, it's potentially really, really bright. So OLED is a version of this, but OLED is done with organic materials, which is much harder to control. It's just not as good. Micro LED is something that the industry has been working on for 20, 30 years. It's never paid off in consumer contexts, but this time Hisense and Samsung are both rolling out a consumer version of it. Mm-hmm. I say consumer version, but it's still going to cost $70,000 for their 136-inch version from Hisense. But obviously,
well, 136-inch is a huge television.
Yeah, so for like their base model, like 70 inches, that's going to be like $9,000 or something like that. So it's still expensive, but it's going to come down.
But it will come down, because when flat screens first appeared, they were also in that price range for much smaller TVs. And then, of course, now, you know, a 55-inch TV is under $500.
And the most hilarious thing about, you know, the 136-inch Hisense, whatever, is that it's not going to ship as one piece. They're going to ship it as a frame and 25 panels. And this is also the fun thing about micro LED TVs is that they're infinitely expendable. Because it goes edge to edge, you can just put however many panels you want. Right. It's not one big panel. You're not worried if that one pixel dies, you have to replace the entire panel. You just take the small panel, rip it out, put in a new one. Yeah. So the TV is becoming a lot more modular and replaceable as well. In other display tech, you know, people have always been talking about VR, AR, XR. You know, like the look up glasses. Let's go right in your eyes. I tried one from the company called Rokit this time. They're based in Hangzhou, and they're one of the, I think, top three AR glasses makers in the world. It's really cool this time because they've built, you know, this cool like 200-inch screen right in your glasses. But they've also now integrated kind of an Android controller that basically replaces your phone. And it's actually very intuitive. It used to be that AR glasses, the only real usage is connecting it to your laptop so it replaces your screen. Right. But now it's kind of its own system, and it retails for $699 US starting in February. It ships in February. It's not cheap, but it's also not like completely out of the range of what consumers could afford for this kind of a thing. Yep. So I think that could potentially be really interesting to see if it takes off. So like there's kind of a ton of stuff. Let me see if there's anything else. Projectors, I don't think people care about projectors. Although I got a free one, that was very nice. Vacuums, this is the really last thing I want to talk about.
Okay.
Vacuums is huge this time. This is at XES. There's like 50 different smart vacuums. But I'm going to talk about the most fun one, which is that there's a vacuum, and everyone's talked about this, vacuum with a robotic extendable arm that goes right from the middle of the vacuum, and then it just picks up stray socks and items and toys, whole idea is that what's been stopping vacuums, automatic robotic vacuums, from being effective is obstacles on the floor.
Right.
But if you can just literally have a robotic arm that picks up things and deposits in a predesignated,
moves them out of the way.
Everyone loved it. It was crazy. Everyone loved this. So, like, I think you know, next year we're going to see, like, 30 different robotic arm vacuums. Yeah. So, yeah.
So do they have a robotic vacuum that can deal with dog messes, though?
No.
I've heard of the horror stories where the dog has an accident and the robot and the vacuum heads out to do its routine and spreads that all over the house.
So that was my thought process as well. And the answer appears to be no. Because if they could deal with dog messes, it would be like worth $1 trillion tomorrow on a NASDAQ. And so, like, I think that maybe there should be a suggestion box for the next CES, you know, create a vacuum that could deal with dog messes. And we'll see, hopefully. It's a great note on that.
I want to just bring something very briefly.
Yeah.
The idea of picking fruit or picking berries.
Yeah.
Are we looking at a robot, just an arm, not like a humanoid thing, just the arm, be connected to a machine that would be able to do that?
Yes.
How far away are we from being able to pick apples in a orchard? How far away?
Perfect. This is a great question. I'm going to take 30 seconds to address it because I almost forgot to mention this. So in terms of the progression of where robots are going, I think in 2 or 3 years, we're going to see hospitality robots, restaurant robots, retail robots. So retail robots that can follow your clothes, can deliver food to you, can maybe even potentially cook your food, but definitely can serve your food. Now, in terms of where the next stage is, I think is agricultural robots. Robots that can spray, you know, like the necessary, you know, materials, can pick the fruit, can, you know, manage the crops and stuff like that. And way after that, I think down the road, 5 to 10 years, maybe longer, we're going to see construction robots. So I think that's going to be the order how it gets rolled out, because robots are going to get rolled out in this order from the most ordered to the least ordered environments. So the most ordered environments are like a restaurant, even without the humans, restaurants, you know, stores, stuff like that. And then the less ordered items will be like, you know, stuff to do with dirt. So, like, you know, orchards, farms, stuff like that. And the least ordered environments will be like where construction equipment is. And that will be much further down the road. Because every increase in disorder in a robotic environment is exponentially difficult for robots. It's not like for us where it's linearly difficult. It's exponentially difficult for robots. But yes, I think we're going to see it because, you know, it's been like this Jetson-like dream for 20, 30, 50 years. But I think now finally we've kind of got the cheap software to do it, and we've also got the cheap enough hardware to do it. Like, I mean, the actuators, which is kind of the thing that actually connects robotic and limbs and make them move and stuff like that, previously, you know, it would be like $20,000, $30,000. But because China and Japan and Korea have been cranking so many industrial robots, which use basically the same actuators, they've become a lot cheaper. So you can build really cool robots for a reasonable price. Is it gonna be a robotic future in our homes? I don't know. That's a different question. But are they coming? Yes.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Stephen Fan.
No worries.
Just back from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And so much going on. We only really covered maybe half the topics you were hoping to, but.
This is the story with every single show.
Yeah.
You know, like, you get to cover maybe like a third, maybe like a quarter of what you really want to, and you just keep looking every single year, and they keep you coming back.
Awesome. Well, you'll be back with some other reports in the future.
Yeah.
Arch reports and stuff, so maybe you can pick up one of these topics from time to time and fill us in.
Synthesize.
Awesome. Thanks so much. It's looks like a brave new world of robots coming our way. And it's hard, you know, maybe, well, it does definitely sounds exciting. It definitely also sounds a little worrisome in the scope of jobs that could be eliminated. I'm thinking about agriculture and retail and other spaces. Anyway, that's a whole nother story that's a little too big for us to get into now. Thanks, Stephen, for being here.
Pleasure as always.
All right. Next up, we have an interview from Danny Nesradani with SFU's Sterling Whiting about presentation and performance.
Sanders Whiting is a specialist in voice and presentation skills, affiliated with the Center for Educational Excellence at Simon Fraser University. Sanders has been instrumental in supporting faculty, staff, and teaching assistants at SFU since 2014. Leveraging his diverse background as a professional actor, Sanders brings considerable knowledge and expertise to his practice. Over the next few months, Sanders Whiting will be hosting a series of workshops on voice and presentation skills at Simon Fraser University. CJSF was able to sit down with Sanders Whiting and speak on his development process for these workshops, as well as what he hopes SFU faculty and staff are able to take away from his teachings. Please take a listen. Today in studio, I am joined with Sanders Whiting. Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, the first thing I want to ask is if you could just give a brief overview of the sort of voice and speech instructing that you do here at SFU.
Sure. The category for what I do is called voice and presentation skills. They go together, of course, really well. And so what I focus on is how people use their voice to make this just the sound of their voice effective, and then also how they use text. That's usually what we mean by speech. It's how are they using text. And there's a lot of things that fall into that category, two of them being enunciation or diction, and the other one being emphasis. And so those are two things that strongly affect text, for example. And the other things are how you are in your body, how comfortable a person is with gesture, whether they feel shaky or whether they feel grounded. So finding ways to ground people is really, it really nurtures their confidence. And so feelings of confidence is a huge thing. A lot of people feel nervous, and so I tend to help people reframe that in a way that makes them feel more empowered.
That empowerment aspect, that seems to be a big part of the work you do. How did you get involved in the first place?
My background is in theater, music, and education. So I'm a professional actor. I have been teaching for about 11, 12 years teaching, started teaching singing, and then got pulled into the voice and speech world. Somebody who I knew that held my current position at SFU, which is with the Center for Educational Excellence, she said, "I think you'd be the right person to take over my job." And I came in to SFU and started teaching people about voice and presentation skills. I've been doing that since 2014. Mm. And the training in theater, of course, naturally lends itself really well to teaching voice and presentation skills. I teach a lot of the things. I teach some very complicated, intense diction exercises that you learn if you would, say, work at a place like the Royal Shakespeare Company in England. I use top-quality content in my workshops.
What would you say is the most rewarding thing when it comes to the work you do and the people that you help with vocal training?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I hate to use an overused word, empowering people. Mm-hmm. When you see somebody that came in and they're nervous and they know they always get nervous and their voice gets shaky and they discover how to overcome that, and they are often surprised that it's a lot easier than they think. Not that it doesn't take practice, but anytime you get to a job where when people leave the session, you can tell that they've got a new tool that they can confidently take forward. It's pretty pleasurable as a teacher.
Would you say when it comes to people developing their presentation skills and their vocal skills, are there any sort of pitfalls or misconceptions that you think people have regarding how they can improve those things?
Yeah, there's probably a few. One of the pitfalls is thinking that you're born with a particular type of voice and it's stuck that way. Our voices can do a huge variety of things. The voice we use is generally the voice that we're just habituated to, that we use, that we feel it's okay, it works. But people can do such a huge array of things with their voices. It doesn't matter what age they're at, they can always improve it, make it more powerful, get greater range. Another thing is that you need to put on a show, that people think, oh, I have to present, I have to put on a show. And an interesting thing that's come along, I think, with so many things on the our world, with everything's on video and YouTube and things like this, is we've got a really strong sense, sort of a sensory thing about people being full of baloney, right? And so one great mentor that I got to work with, and all the courses I took with him were online. He's an American singing teacher and presentation skills teacher. And his videos originally were very slick, beautifully lit. And then I noticed one day he switched and there was just a brick wall in the background. I think he was just using his phone. And this was about 10 years ago. And I was surprised at my feeling that I kind of trusted him more because he took away the special lighting and all that stuff. Nothing wrong with that stuff. It's an art in itself. But realizing that people are enough, and that's a little phrase we use for actors a lot of the time. Actors are trying to be bigger than they are to fill the shoes of Hamlet or somebody really famous. But actually, it's learning to ground yourself in a sense of just being who you are in your body. I am enough. It gives you a sense of authenticity. And you may have noticed that things have gone from being really splashy and hard sell, you know, like 10 years ago, to now people are really trying to appeal to you that I'm telling you the truth, that it's not fake news, right? And so just people relaxing and being themselves. And one of the things that they can counter this feeling of having to put on a performance is that you're really there to serve the people that you're talking to. Mm-hmm. And that changes your status. When you change your status to somebody that I'm here to help, I may not be perfect, but I'm here to help these people, it can change your feeling of how being in the room is. And so that, along with accepting who you are and then go, I'm here to help, I'll do whatever I can to help, that is usually a huge paradigm shift in people's heads, that going, oh, I could make a mistake up here, but I'm here to help people, so I'll keep going forward in a bolder way.
The way you described it there, it's so much more than just developing a skill to be utilized in a career or academic setting. There's a degree of learning to accept yourself.
Well, and that's what I think a lot of people want. If you're going to buy a car from somebody, You're hoping the person's authentic and real. And I think that's almost a kind of a new aesthetic that we have. If you hear somebody on a talk show, you want to hear who they are. You want to hear the real person. You'll see a lot more people exposing how vulnerable they are as people on talk shows and things. And it's kind of a new thing of people, in some ways, being allowed to be more human. And I think that's something that we really gravitate towards. And another way to call it is bringing the whole person into the room. I'm not just bringing a performer into the room. I'm bringing me with all my foibles. And it's interesting. It's even a technique some people use. They make a mistake early on purpose, so people can go, oh, you make mistakes too? Oh, I like you. I can identify with you. So I don't purposefully do that, but I don't try to make mistakes. But if I make one, people can see that, oh, you're a human being too, and it makes one much more relatable.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to ask you is, because the workshops you're doing here at Simon Fraser University are sort of a series of ongoing workshops, and all of them sort of tackle different aspects of presentation and vocal skills. How did you develop that, and how did you choose, you know, which specific aspects of presentation giving to sort of focus in on for each person, or for each workshop in this case?
Well, I love that question, because when I first came to it, I was coming from the theater world, and I've worked a lot, and I've started getting back into it as an actor on big stages with lots of people, sometimes with, very often without a mic. Many stages don't have mics. And so I'm coming into the room and with this feeling in my body, it should feel like this, it should be this presentation, big thing, and realizing over time, that's not quite what people need. And what I would find through doing many workshops since 2014, I do from two to eight workshops a month, and then I do private sessions. And this is all for faculty or graduate students who teach or instructional staff that teach, right? It's got to be somebody. People can work with me as long as I'm doing something with them that has to do with teaching. And I lost my chain of thought there. Where was I? And so how did I develop these things? So it's people coming into the room and going, so what would you like to explore today? And people, if they've made an appointment, especially for a private appointment, they know exactly what they want to do. They'll go, oh, my voice, I stand up and it starts to get shaky. It never does that with my family, or things like that. And I say, oh, well, let's address stability in the voice. Most of what people come to me for are either voice problems. They feel that they don't know how to project. And projection's actually quite simple. You can teach people to do it fairly quickly. It's more a psychological shift. And then the other things are nervousness in their body, shaking, shaky voice, shaky hands, and really teaching them to ground themselves in their body. And then just feelings of nervousness, which they'd like to transform into feelings of confidence. So those are largely the things, vocal things, then how do you live in your body, how do you relax in your body, and how do you feel more confident? Those are the three major things that, and I get surveys after courses too, after workshops, and say, was that beneficial to you? The feedback is so useful, and say, what else might you like to explore? What else would you like to see? So that's how I determine what gets offered in a workshop.
The major last thing I want to ask you is if you can tell me what you hope the people that attend these workshops and that attend your instructional sessions, what do you hope their main takeaway is, you know, after just one of these workshops or sessions?
To be generous. That's the biggest thing. That's the biggest paradigm shift in one's head. It's not to outperform somebody. It's not to bamboozle somebody. It's to really be there to serve people. It will take away your nervousness and look at everything in presentation skills as generosity. Volume is generosity, making it so people can easily hear you. They don't have to lean in and try to read your lips because they can't hear things well enough. So anything like that. Volume, even pretending you're a little bit confident, instills confidence in your audience. So you can even fake that out of it as a form of generosity. I'm going to behave generously, so you'll buy into the things that I'm talking about. So I would say generosity and a bit of boldness.
All right. I believe that is all the time we have for this interview, but I want to thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me on these presentations that you have going on at the moment. Would you like to say any sort of last words on this workshop series or just the work you do at SFU for any faculty or students that may be listening?
Well, I'd like to encourage people that their voice is it represents them in a huge way. It's kind of like their signature. When you walk into a room, and to be generous with your voice, to be generous with the energy that you have, that reads really well. And for people in university transitioning into careers and things like that, going into a room with a generous boldness, people will like that. Not everybody will, but I would assume most people go, I can work with that, I'll hire that. And if you're faculty and you go into a room with a generous sort of happy boldness, students feel that. They feel attended to. They feel taken care of and that you're concerned about them. So, yeah, taking in this sort of concern for other people, I'd say that's the biggest message.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Danny.
Once again, you were listening to our conversation with Sanders Whiting, Teaching Enhancement Specialist at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. This piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Attention, women in science, technology, engineering, and math. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting on your journey, the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology is here to support you every step of the way. From mentorship programs to networking and skill-building events, we've got the tools and resources you need to succeed and thrive in STEM. Visit SCWIST.ca to learn more. That's SCWIST.ca. We can't wait to connect with you.
My name's Katie. You want some cool new music to listen to? Want to know about up-and-coming artists, albums, and more? Well, come hang out with me every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Raccoon City's where I'll be. Hope to see you there.
Tune in every Tuesday at noon for Raccoon City. Now we have Peter R.H.,
so April,
we had a number of things we're going to talk about, but tell us about April 1st.
April, she was one of, at times, there's only four of us, the two people that set up the UBC Anarchist Club 40 yeah. years ago, and it was me and this woman, April Page, who I was, one time I remember we had a long bus ride together, and that was it, but I've seen her three times since. Had a few discussions. She may or may not be part of the shows in the future. And here's a statement from her. This is her statement. I don't believe we do ourselves a favor by bowing down to the belief that one particular nation, any nation for that matter, is the most powerful nation in the world. This notion appears to me to originate in a fabricated glorification of the military industrial complex. While some celebrated dignitaries like President Biden, President Obama, and many of their forerunners have proclaimed that the United States is the most powerful nation in the world, it is now shown that China is the global leader in industrial manufacturing. And Russia recently demonstrated that it has the greatest non-nuclear weapons capacity with its arsenic long-range intercontinental ballistic missile. This weapon is claimed to, quote, streak to its target at 10 times the speed of sound, unquote, and to be, quote, immune to any missile defense system, unquote. So to me, these examples alone stand to derail the concept of, quote, the greatest national power on earth, unquote, at least within the current military industrial complex model. For those who hold even a nanoparticle common sense, it is obvious that every nation has both outstanding accomplishments as well as its embarrassing failures. If we could abandon domineering power games among nations, we could mobilize the saying, knowledge is power for everyone, and so uncover a wealth of power and security growing exponentially among the 8 billion strong population we are. This might require some cooperation, working together, or as children are taught to do on the Sesame Street TV program. Politicians could proudly share their legislative success with politicians in other regions, saying this policy or this bill, which we reenacted, worked very successfully for our area, or why don't you give it a try? Or contrarily, we waste a lot of time, effort, and money developing this other plan, so don't waste your time on that one. And conversely, reserving governments could in turn cooperate in such interactions by proudly sharing their success while warning of the duds. Do you think such cooperation, sharing agreements are too idealistic? They are amplified already every moment in the provision of shared instructional videos of the internet. Human beings like to share what they are good at and to offer warnings against weaker actions. Leaderships from each nation can do the same thing. So that's a statement she made.
Yeah.
And I think that right now, with the threat of the tariffs on Canada from the president-elect Donald Trump, it's more America first, as in make America great again, because it's, you know, we're going to make sure we're going to trip you over or something. And I was wondering, Stephen, if you could maybe, this time remaining, kind of talk about the likelihood of the tariffs or maybe so on, the pre-existing trade agreements that exist and so on this.
Yeah, so I think just a few quick points. I think, first of all, you know, Canada has, and the United States, and to some extent Mexico, have signed a series of trade agreements, most famously NAFTA of 94, and which has been updated to USMCA during the first Trump term. So the integrated economic structure has always existed. I think the difficulty in looking at this from the Canadian perspective is that it is an all-consuming question and even obsession for us, but it is not a huge deal for the Americans. It's not a huge question for the Americans. Now, if a trade is actually disrupted across borders because of tightly integrated supply chains and stuff like that, it will become a huge deal. If we cut off electricity supply, it would be a huge deal. But if you go, like, you know, I was recently in the United States, obviously, but, like, if you go anywhere in the United States, it doesn't matter if you're in rural Washington State or in New York City, like, 90% of the political conversation normal people have is about stuff like, you know, public order, crime, and to some extent right now the wildfires in L.A., and then, you know, stuff like border security, immigration. Like, the word Canada and trade simply just does not – it's just not on the radar. And I think that's part of the huge challenge in having this conversation from the Canadian side, is that for us it's a huge deal. For normal Americans, they just don't care. And they don't really have any reason to care right now until their lives get disrupted. And I think, you know, I think a misguided political strategy in Canada, at least among, you know, some people, is to try and get Americans to care. Well, you might get them to care, but they will be annoyed. You know, it's better if you just don't get to that point. My own view is that, you know, the moment Trump takes office, there's going to be so many different things that Canada is going to seem, and trade, North American trade, is going to seem like an absolutely minuscule concern to him. There are no real problems. He's picking on imaginary problems, right? All the theoretical problems they had were fixed last time anyways. They have exactly the auto sector they want. They have a bunch of manufacturing and service sector integrations they want. There's nothing they could change that would make them happy. They were just looking for an issue in the weird several sort of lame duck month after the election and before inauguration, where they could have a risk-free bet and just pick a risk-free issue to go on Fox News about. I don't think that's what's going to happen the moment he's president. He's going to have real issues, issues like the Middle East, issues like, to some extent, and this is something right-wing radio jocks care a lot about, you know, the southern border, issues like various things.
If I could just interject here, if he's planning to go ahead with the tariffs, what would be the timeline of this happening?
If he is planning to go ahead with the tariffs, first of all, they will almost certainly get stopped by the courts. So, you know, there will be a bunch of legal challenges, and most of the supposed tariffs will get stopped by the courts. So he doesn't have completely unilateral authority on this. The president has a lot of authority over trade, but it's not unlimited.
So we're not talking about it immediately happening.
We're at least 3 or 4 months away.
Okay.
We have just a minute left. I have a quick question. Do these court challenges, are they coming out of the signed agreements between three countries?
So the agreement itself has a dispute resettlement mechanism, and Canada actually insisted very strongly on this, knowing that it was dealing with Trump last time, and it turns out this time as well. So that has that's a fairly neutral process,
right.
And so it's not I mean, he can impose tariffs at the end of the day on U.S. authority. But, like, I think, you know, because this is all we see, this is what we're focused on, but I don't think this is what the Americans are focused on. So I don't think it's going to happen immediately. If it happens immediately, I don't think, you know, they're going to have the political temerity or will to go through with all the ill effects to their own economies. They just
Just interject. If it is immediately, it is like three months away as such, at the very earliest.
If it is immediately, it will last like 3 days. That's the other thing. If it's immediately, like, kind of going to turn off the electricity in New York State, okay. it would cut off Alberta oil exports in the United States, the U.S. will flip the next day. But you know, if you are talking about a sustained level of tariffs as a strategic thing, we're at least 3-6 months away, right? So overnight tariffs stay overnight.
Thank you. We're out of time today. You've been listening to